And we're rolling on the Union Working podcast at Culver City Studios with Podcast Sage. Union Working is a grassroots organization of film, television, and commercial performers of SAG-AFTRA.
We are dedicated to solutions, ideas, and creating a union that works for all of us. So we hope you will enjoy our informative, entertaining, and at times irreverent podcast about the challenges facing the modern-day union actor.
We support a membership-driven membership model because
We are the union.
People, hello.
Holy goodness. What a collection. This is, I said it's like a pool party. What an amazing collection of folks we have today, guys, for the Union Working Podcast to talk about modified contract agreements, low budget, modified low budget, ultra low budget. It's outstanding. And we have a room full of people we get to go around real quick. So a man who's produced, I've lost track of how many shows, but I still want to laugh at having cast Sharknado 3. Mr. Gerald Webb, please say hi.
Hi.
Kind of, can you say I love Philadelphia or something? Anything?
Yeah, go Eagles and Sixers.
Whatever. We also have a man who's right in the middle of doing an action web series called Valerie, Mr. Max Kleiman. Max, say hi.
Hi, everybody.
Going around the room, we also have Stephanie McBain, who, writer, director, released a couple of features, Roads, Trees, and Honeybees, and Kiss on Candy Lane. Am I getting that right?
Candy Cane Lane. Yes, that's it.
Thank you, Stephanie, for being here. And, of course, the person that you've now said, it's not our fault, but you said you make her do all the paperwork for you guys, and that would be Miss Elizabeth Anderson. Elizabeth, say hi.
Hello, everybody.
And last, not even last but least, but getting the direction.
Thanks a lot for that. I appreciate it.
This is, I feel like I'm doing a Christmas party or something. a bunch of producing low-budget stuff, but also Broke LA and the Low Budget Film Festival, Miss Anna Schumacher. Anna,
yes.
Say hi.
Hi. Hello.
Awesome. And I am Kevin E. West. I am UW Podcast, UW Core, and my fellow UW Union Working Man, who's also part of the Core, Mr. Matthew Jager.
That's true. Last and apparently in Q's view, least.
We're both least.
That's
We're just
true.
Both the least. And because this is and has been for such a long time, this is one of the things where I kind of like being old, but not really, and going all the way back to when half this room was like under 12 years old. When these films, it's not my fault, man. When these films were called Limited Exhibition, SAG Experimental.
I remember that one.
Oh, you do? Oh, yeah. You are actually older than I thought you were. I have a real quick opening for each one of you, and I want to bust around. And I can't wait to hear this question. Real quick, fast question, answer on the love and hate about low budget or new media producing.
I mean, what I love about it is you can't fix things with money, so you have to use your creativity, you have to use your team, you have to grow. I mean, every shoot we do, in multiple ways, things happen where I'm like, how do we deal with this? And we have to grow and expand and figure out a way to expand. So I love that. And I love the idea that everybody usually working on our cast and our crew, they have somewhere they're trying to get to. And if you inspire them, they'll go through a wall because it's an opportunity for them to help move toward where they want to go. It's not just, oh, it's a 9-to-5. Let me do the job and, you know, mail it in. Hopefully, if we do our jobs right in creating great content. So that's the love. The hate, I don't know if there's a hate. I mean, if I hated it, I don't think I'd be a filmmaker. I mean, there's things that annoy the crap out of me. But
okay, maybe hate was a strong word. How about really aggravating on a regular basis?
Yeah. One of the things we're going to talk about today is like, I'm a member of the Screen Actors Guild, and I want my union to be strong, but I also work with them as a multiple companies that are signatories in good standing, and sometimes they're really, really not conducive to doing business.
Okay. Max, we're not going to use the word hate now. Gerald's already shut that down. So love and ugh.
Annoying on a regular basis.
Yeah.
The thing I love is working just with like a small team, small crew, everybody working together to just sort of hustle and make something happen. The race against the clock element of it, I always sort of like. And I hate the paperwork. It's just not where my mental facilities really lie with sitting filling in forms all the time. So I actually on my latest thing got somebody else hired somebody on to do most of the paperwork, which was the best decision I ever made.
See, Elizabeth just got another job.
Hello.
Not that she wants the damn thing. I'm just saying she got another job. Love and UGG.
I guess I'm just more grateful, and that's where the love comes from, because you do get to, you know, kind of base your career off of something. Everybody has to start somewhere. And if these independent modified budget contracts weren't in place, I might not be able to work with union, non-union, and then get that one actor with the name that might be able to elevate me to the next step as well. So it is kind of like stepping stones, and it's grateful to have those opportunities there. I don't understand the paperwork. I think it's ignorance on my part sometimes. When I read it, it's just a lot of words and papers and contract, and it scares me. So it is nice when you can find a producer that knows what they're doing, that you also trust.
Just, you know, everybody knows she looked right at Elizabeth when she said
she's making moony eyes at Elizabeth if she says that.
Elizabeth is falling out of the chair.
Something else coming. Something else is coming.
You know, and you have to trust them too, because there's once the paperwork is done and the contract's done, then I'm like, okay, great. Now I get to make the movie. Now I'm excited. But before then, I'm like,
Elizabeth, I mean, is there something besides the paperwork, since that seems, you seem to have like seven more jobs now, right now, coming here to the podcast, you just got hired four more times. But as far as the actual filmmaking part of this, or other elements of, is there something that you really dig about doing these kinds of projects?
I actually don't mind the paperwork. I'm big on organization. And as a SAG-AFTRA member myself, coming into the producing side of it, I got a totally different perspective. I know people like myself, when we're working, when actors are working, everything is documented. They're getting paid on time. They're treated with respect. So I like that they have that. There's, you know, the structure behind working with these union jobs. That one of the things I dislike is at first, with the amount of paperwork, it can be overwhelming. But I'm like, I've done this before. I can, you know, get through it. And just staying on top of the business reps, you know, communicating, following up constantly is like one of the things that, it just comes with the job. So
do you have a secret out there? Like, you send them, like, I don't know, maybe vodka filled chocolate or anything? Like, do you have a secret for the business?
Once we get greenlit, I mean, sometimes I send a little something, you know, just to thank you. I appreciate you. I'll see you next round.
Anna, do you have a unique love and a unique ugh that we haven't heard to date?
I was just going to say, it's like such a room of such smart people, and you guys have said it so well. I think it's clear that a lot of people obviously represented here start because of that. Creating a small team of, hey, we're just going to go fucking do this. I think I just said the first swear word.
Yeah!
I did. We're going to go fucking do this thing.
See, we thought the episode started 5 minutes ago, but no, it fucking started now. Not a girl.
Oh. And so that's what I love about it, is being able to keep pushing forward and to have the access to such talented people who have made that next step in their career, and that's wonderful. And the frustrating part that I have found for me, which here's this lovely lady who solved the problem, but taking that time for the paperwork and the administrative stuff, not even just about not being able to understand it or not having kind of the knowledge ahead of time to start it, but just the hours of doing the paperwork, someone has to be paid to do it, or you have to be willing to wear a bunch of hats and do it yourself, and that can cut into other budgetary needs or time, or, and that can be kind of hard to prioritize and how and who and when.
Is it really more the time guy? Because I think about school and I think about us all doing taxes, and is it really the actual paperwork language and figuring it out, or is it really just, Jesus, I wanted to stop doing this shit when I was 18 in terms of taking the time to fill it out?
The thing about it is, early on, it really is daunting, because you may not understand it, and so then it's like, it's a different challenge. So that for me, what I kind of took that challenge on and kind of was like, I wanted to understand it. But once you do understand it, sometimes it's just the amount of paperwork that you have to do and the amount of documentation that you have to do. And the truth of it is, if you don't get it right, your whole film cannot be sellable, because you don't have one contractor, you don't have this. So that's the stakes are so high, I think, is the problem.
That's, when you said taxes, I thought that was a really good metaphor, because it's like, you're paying people, like, you know, as an entertainer, I pay a tax guy to do my taxes for me, because there's a ton of paperwork, I don't understand it all, and the stakes are so high that if I make a mistake, it's going to cost me a lot down the road. And I just want to point out that while you were talking about the stack of paperwork, the heads in the room were all, you can't hear it, but they were all nodding up and down.
How many people have been audited?
Everybody here knows, like, what their binders look like at the end of a movie. You think, oh, I'll have a little binder. No, you have multiple binders for each different area, and it's, you have to go buy a huge boxes to,
brother,
store them in
office,
forever.
You have a bookshelf. You have a bookshelf of binders.
And one, like, one one 6-foot bookshelf might hold 2 movies full of binders.
Damn.
One big bookshelf.
Because you never know what might come up, you know, later on where they need to, you know, have proof of something or something that payroll might have missed. Like, you just have to keep everything. So I have stuff from our film we did, you know, a few years ago.
We did this military piece called Embedded, and it was like, by the time we shot it and then got distribution for it, 2 years later, I was doing all that work, and I was like, hey, do you have this contract from this person? Do you have this? Because the list of deliverables, I was like, I don't know. I mean, I take pictures of paper, but I need to get better.
Well, yeah, and then you have to scan it all and back it up. But then here's the other issue.
Every paper.
Say you get distribution for your movie, and it's a 3-year deal or 5-year or 7-year deal. Well, you may have another chance to put that movie on another platform down the road. You will have to re-deliver all these documents to the new platform or the new distributor potentially. So you have to have it all almost forever.
Max, are you getting all this? Because you're right in the middle of doing the deliverables as we speak,
oh my God,
man.
Yeah, it's
Max, Max just passed out during the last 5 minutes.
My eyes definitely glazed over a little bit. But also one other just little detail that hasn't gotten mentioned directly yet is the timing of it in terms of like going into production. Because so much of it, you got to start your paperwork so far ahead so that you've got time to get everything in place and for the person at the union to clear everybody and work through whatever speed bumps you get. And when it's, you know, when it is like really low budget or you're trying to like put something together kind of fast, it's really easy to suddenly not to like be holding off. Everything's precarious and you wait till you lock like this one thing for this one date, and then suddenly there's a date and oh no, it's in a week and a half, and you can't do it, and you got to sort of start everything from scratch and move it all months later to just make sure everything is in place when it needs to be.
That also
go ahead, Anna.
That can also kind of that impacts your creative part as well, because you have to have your script submitted a certain amount of time ahead of time. And if you're kind of working out some kinks, or you're a little bit more of kind of scrappy writing team, you're trying to work out those kinks and you don't have it quite on time, then you have to push your production back, and your DP is like, well, we have to shoot this at this time, I'd like to shoot this at this time, and now you're telling camera department, well, I don't have the we have to wait a week because I don't have this paper in yet. And then the whole creative kind of process can be a little bit shifted around too, and that's a lot to manage, and that can be really challenging when you have a very, very small tiny film, tiny budget, not a lot of time.
And a short amount of time, right? I mean, you're probably locked a location or two, and all of a sudden you're going to run out of a thing with a guy and a goat and a balloon.
And you've gotten like one permit, actually, and you're like trying to.
I would be interested in hearing from you guys sort of maybe the most heroic or how you worked it out. Because, I mean, I think I come at it from a performer, but I've done a lot of low budget projects. And one of the fun things is that it's always so flexible and things are sort of even forming on set as you do it. But having all that paperwork, it seems like you have to have almost a lot of planning and things set ahead of time, and yet be able to change things at the very last minute. If, say, your DP is asked to go shoot on a much more expensive project, you know, because everybody's doing another job. I mean, this is not paying all our bills right up front.
Well, clearly you have to call Elizabeth.
Clearly.
Yeah. Clearly.
I think we got to put her email at the end of this.
Yeah, Elizabeth's going to get like 9 jobs out of this and never sleep again. I'm going to talk about the elephant in the room, because it's the nature of the conversation we're having. We just finally, and I do think it was overdue for performers, because while I appreciate wanting to do the love of art and filmmaking, we still want to use professionals and have them be union projects, but we are struggling in this country and also this business to not pay people who have decades of experience literally nothing. But that changes the budget now, doesn't it, for all of us? So I'm going to bring up the elephant in the room of, in the last 5 to 10 years, and I don't know if that applies to everybody in this room, raising money. Raising money for these projects, finding enough money, it doesn't matter whether it's low budget, modified, ultra, even a short. How much has trying to raise money changed in the time since you went to do your first one to today? It's a free-for-all, because this is a pool party, so fire away. Whoever wants to go first, fire away. How's it changed? Stephanie's right at the mic. She's ready to go.
I don't know about that one. I did a short film that we did like a GoFundMe for and stuff like that. And the people that contributed, we had friends and family and friends of family and stuff contribute a little bit. And then she put money in, and I put money in, my grandma, mom, everybody contributed, you know, that really wanted to support us. And that was cool. And it got a step in the right direction. You know, then I did a feature, which I invested most of myself, which still pay for, it's paying for, you know, how every...
Nice.
Yeah, well, we work a lot to be able to do that. But that also, that movie being released got me an investor for another one. So then it's kind of just a domino effect, and it's the more exposure and the more people can see what you can do on a budget can lead to the next project, so... I don't know about crowdfunding anymore for me. I don't think it's my thing anymore. I want to, because I want to film something again, but I don't know. You have to weigh the options.
Hi, it's Jack Levy, producer of the Union Working Podcast and partner at Podcast Sage. As an awarded audio producer who's contributed to some of the finest feature films, television shows, video games, and records produced, I've been inundated with requests by peers and major studios alike to produce and manage podcast production. And I'd be delighted to do the same for you. Have an idea for a podcast and don't know where to start or who to call? Look no further. Have a scripted podcast, investigative or documentary, interview show, solo cast, game show, talk show, or literally any other project? Give me a call at 818-233-0640. That's 818-233-0640. Or email me at jack@podcastsage.com. We have world-class studios here in Culver City and can work remote, on location, literally anywhere, and have the broadband experience to help with everything from concept development to recording and editing, staffing and writers, and of course, music. Call me at 818-233-0640 or shoot me an email at jack@podcastsage.com. Mention Union Working and get a 10% discount. Hell, I'll make it 15. And now, back to Union Working.
The question is kind of interesting. I think it's tied to something that we're not talking about, and that's how do you recoup that money down the road? So
that's the other elephant in the room.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, raising funds is easier if I can go to an investor and go, yeah, remember I made you 20% on your money on that last movie. Yeah. Then it's easier potentially to get him to put up money for the next movie. So, and that's really what the elephant in the room is. When we talk in, you know, being tied to union contracts and rates that people are paid and things like that. I don't think any of us, unless, you know, there's the red herring movie that, you know, you make this movie really low and for some reason it just explodes and somebody becomes a millionaire.
Sure.
That's not the majority of the movies that are being made on these ULB or modified low budgets. Even these movies that maybe go get a television deal, the producers aren't really getting rich off of them. The tricky thing is how do you recoup enough so that you can continue to make more films? Because I don't know, maybe you guys are better at it than me, but I haven't made a movie where I'm like, oh, I made that movie and I sold it. Now I can go sit on a beach for 2 years. It just doesn't happen.
You tried once, but then you called me from the beach and it didn't work out.
Yeah, I was like, can I get a self-tape?
Very true. But in terms of that, but also with regards to being able to recoup it, have you seen the situation with low budget projects change in terms of trying to get that one name actor you talk about, in terms of the negotiation with representatives? Because, I was sitting in your office one day and we sat there for 30 minutes trying to come up with how much has that evolved in just the last five years in terms of that one person who's going to help you get that next one that helps get you that next money with that next guy. How's that changed in the last 5 years?
Well, to be truthful, and it's not one name anymore. Unless you get like a true A-list name, distributors are like, okay, that's good. Now, who else can you get?
Well, Max has.
They want three names or four names. And they don't want, the thing about it is they don't want these moderate level names that we can maybe get for these projects. They want the names that we can't get for the project. That's how difficult it is now.
I know you probably, nobody here necessarily wants to name names. I get it. But can you give just like an A+ to a B- scenario of how that's changed? I mean, have we gone from one B+ to I need a B+ and an A-?
Let me put a twist on that, because there's been...
Are you going to dance?
I could if you like.
No, please don't.
I would tap then, but the question is, so as we've seen sort of like A-listers, A-list movie stars are not coming down and doing TV. And so major TV stars are sort of taking either smaller roles there or doing... Is that part of what's affected as far as when they're like, well, yo, you know, like if Al Pacino is doing an Amazon series, why can't you get this other A-lister to come do this low budget movie? Is that, do you think there's any connection in that mentality?
The problem is the Amazon series isn't a low budget series.
Everybody
wants to discount it because it's streaming, but it's not a low budget series. They have millions and millions of dollars that they're making that project with. So Al Pacino's getting
his budget SVOD.
Yeah. Right.
No, he's, no argument. I'm just wondering if that's affected the mentality of the investors who aren't necessarily as savvy about that.
Well, this is the tricky thing. I have investors that sometimes love certain actors, and that's great. And they may want to put money up for those actors. Those actors, a lot of times, may not be the actors that the distribution wants. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, for you to try and hopefully make your money back, you have to have a distributor. I think they hold all the power now. And as much as there's all these outlets for these independent projects, I feel like there's bigger companies that are controlling more. Of, you know, it used to be you could make a feature film, we would go sell the rights at a market for the U.S. that might get us close to, you know, out of the red into the black, and then we could go sell all these territories all over the country and hopefully make a little bit of profit. Now a company like Amazon, a company like Netflix, they want it all, and they're going to use their size, their girth, their power to negotiate to give you the least amount of money that you can and the least favorable terms for you.
And you also have to pay back the overhead to the distributor for costs.
Wow.
So, and then you have to pay back your investor and interest or things like that. So it's very difficult. And also DVD sales are down, you know, people aren't doing that when they have like six different streaming services where they can get really great content. So where does that leave the independent market?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. And remember, in most cases, you know, you said you paid for your movie yourself, you know, a lot of the investment, or you have investors that we're responsible for that money. Like, as the independent producer, you're taking on 100% of the risk. A distributor's not taking on that risk. Amazon's not taking on that risk. They may take it on later when the product's done. Are like, oh, okay, now we think we can do something. We're taking it on from minute one.
Anna, did you?
Yeah, I was going to say that people like Amazon or like Netflix, they can produce a lot of their own content, and maybe 90% of that content is stuff that's on like page 7 or 8 down there that doesn't cost them so much, but it's bringing in more subscription, so they can have that giant blockbuster television show, quote unquote, that is now supported by all this other money that keeps coming through by their kind of smaller projects or not A-list projects that kind of supports them. And as an independent filmmaker, you can't have like 8 kind of okay movies over here as a cash register, but while you focus on your big one, you're kind of all in on what you're all in on and hoping that the distribution from there on works in your favor, because you don't have all that cash pile behind you.
We don't have ancillary support.
Exactly.
And it goes down a whole rabbit hole, because it starts going down a road that I've chatted with some of the higher ups at SAG-AFTRA about, in terms of where our antitrust laws in this country have gone in the last 35 years. It's absurd, because, I mean, when AT&T was allowed to buy DirecTV, I was like, yeah, that's it. I mean, what ESPN now does as a part of Disney and ABC is 25 years ago, I mean, we're still getting paid rates that they're literally showing shows that are something you would have seen on a network, but they're still considered not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and this has trickled down to these agreements in which all of these conglomerates, as you just said, control the whole nine. Mm-hmm. And it makes it very hard.
It's a weird thing, because most people don't understand it, because they're like, oh, you have so many outlets now. Yes, but first off, so many outlets are controlled by so fewer entities. You know, like you said, Disney controls like half of everything now. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, pretty much. Yeah. And then the other half is controlled, you know what I mean, controlled by two other companies.
Right.
So
Google and don't you guys, we chatted about this once, and I definitely want to hear from you guys in terms of your experience with when you're trying to get distribution. I want you guys to talk about trying to get this, because we've chatted about the intended use loophole. And when you start talking about distribution and lifetime and some of the places in terms of making you whole, they have a lot of ways to get around making you whole-ish, don't they?
Anyone? You know, I appreciate everybody's input, because this part of the, you know, the production process I don't deal with. As far as the distribution, it's something I am looking into getting more into and learning about. I have just seen, just on the back end, just seeing how difficult it is, you know, to get the the backing as far as, you know, financing and to get it distributed. And I remember when it used to be, you know, people come onto a project and they're thinking, oh, we could just sell it to, you know, Netflix and you've made it. When it's not, I've seen where, you know, over the course of the years, like, it's not, you know, that easy anymore. You can't just sell to Netflix. And if you happen to get a contract with, you know, someone like a company like that, it's, you don't, you know, profit anything.
Yeah, the profits come from their original series.
And I still get people saying, like, just, you know, sell it to Netflix. Like,
yeah, you can make a big, you can make a deal that makes you no money with any company. And it can be like, oh, I did a deal.
Write that down real quick.
There's a lot of people out in the world that at one point were like, yeah, I did a deal with the Trump Organization.
Yeah.
And how are they feeling now?
Yeah.
Yep. Well,
I was in a short film. They got distribution with a cable company on one of their individual channels. And she's like, yeah, we made this much. And she handed me the money she had to pay me for the, you know, because they got distribution. And then she told me what she made overall. And I just handed the check right back to her. I'm like, here you go. Like, because I think my pay was nothing anyway. Like, my cut of it was going to be nothing. And what she was getting was laughable. So I was just like, you know what? This, here you go.
As far as the $7.42
like,
back.
Basically, yeah, like, here's, I think it was around that.
I just want to address your you said a loophole question.
Yeah, well, because we chatted about intended use.
Yeah, the truth of it is, I don't see it as a loophole. Basically, as an independent producer, we go find money. We produce a movie. We have no guarantee of any kind of sale. We're taking on all of this risk. Then, of course, when we get the movie completed, or sometimes while we're filming, we'll get a trailer cut and try to go out and get interest in it. We want to get any sale we can get that can hopefully make us whole and pay our investors back. If we can get a TV deal on that film, great. If we can't, then we have to go, you know, you go through the gamut. Can I sell it here? If they say no here, can I get theatrical? No. Can I get a TV deal? No. Can I get, you know, whatever streaming service and DVD or, you know, whatever is your last kind of frontier now. It's not a loophole. I don't have a guarantee that I'm going to sell to a TV network. What the TV networks do is they go, oh, okay, there's a bunch of people making content. We're not going to commit to anybody. We're going to sit back. We're going to see what you make. And then, oh, we'll pick this one and this one and this one. And sometimes you want to call it a loophole, but it's just that's the reality of the market. So I think sometimes where it's looked at as a loophole for the producers, it's not the producers that are taking advantage of anything. Where this... if there's a loophole that exists, it exists where distributors have to be, I feel, have to be made responsible for the content that they buy.
Hey Q, can you, why don't you, for maybe those of us, okay, I outed myself there, who are listening, who don't entirely know what you mean when you say your intended use loophole, what are you talking about?
Well, I mean, that is as to what Gerald just said, the distribution companies have a way of getting around when they choose to try and take on your project of, they don't actually have to pay for technically in certain ways what it is they're about to buy. They have ways of actually getting around how they buy it and intend to use it, but they don't have to. And I joke about it because I did, I think, 4 movies for Lifetime that are supposed to be movies. But then on my contract, the breakdown came out with a title that said one thing. Mm-hmm. My contract said another name. And by the time
the title of the project,
and by the time the show was actually on it, it was another name. And then it came out and was actually named something different on the DVD. And the way they get around this is an intended use for what it was, but they keep changing it. And so when you try to file a claim with our union, they don't really have any place to go. And as you just addressed, a lot of times what you get back is, we've been trying on this for 2 years and they have $7.42. Yeah. Held and contained within a box of one of those stair steps. So it's a little convoluted. I might agree with you to a degree that it's maybe not as much of an intended loophole, but boy, we're the ones who wind up taking it on the chin when it's all said and done.
You know, it's funny. I would be interested to hear from anybody, but especially since you just talked about it, G. You know, we were talking about, well, I won't go into what we were talking about with commercials, but what, I mean, would it... It almost feels like as these different distribution methods, as so many pop up and they keep changing so quickly, it would almost be best to just separate day rate, what you're paid is your day rate and all your residuals from the intended use and all of that. You have your day rates based on your budget and then, but I don't know how you track it on the back end to get those residuals. Yeah. And that's the part I don't know.
And that's,
I mean, that's what we've tried to do, but it's not quite there yet.
And that's why I brought up with you guys, I said one name. That's you talked about as 70, like get your name and get the one person. But now you said it's two, but it almost sounds to me like you're telling me that in the last 3 to 5 years since I was in your office that day that there's no one you guys or we can bank on, even when you get the two names, that's going to help you get any kind of a distribution that helps you in any way, shape, form, or fashion until it's just sit back and see what happens. Is that really where we are?
I think so. I think everybody from independent film, it's like you have a reason to make it, because I have not recouped all the money from my films yet, but I still am looking to make another one. So it's that love of creating something and want to see it. So the goal is to get distribution, right? But every person who invests in independent film knows the risks and knows that the odds are they're not going to see a dime back. That's just the reality. You can't time the market. The market goes in trends. You can't predict what's going to be popular international or not. A lot of times with independent films, an international sales agent might package 8 features together and sell them and then divide that up, just because your one film isn't strong enough to sell based off of, you don't have the right talent names, you don't have the right anything, story. It might not be fitting one of the trends going on at that time. So you really just don't know. So I guess the goal is to get distribution, but is it because you are holding on to that hope that you're going to make your money back and money to make another one? Or is it because you want to get your name out there? You want to get your creativity out there. You want to get what you can do to hopefully get picked up by one of those bigger companies that can then hire you. And then you know, would get kind of moving out of that independent and could still always do it and always, you know, create your own stuff, because in a sense, when you get picked up, I don't know if I'm saying this right, but when you get picked up, you might lose a little bit of creative control, because now you're working with these big budgets and you have producers that are calling more shots than you do when you're doing independent.
Right. Have you guys gotten surprised in the last, I continue to go back to the last 3 to 5 years just because of where we are with all of the platforms and all the options. Are you getting a little more surprised? Max, you're doing, you know, recently put something out on a breakdown because you're in the middle of doing it on at who you're seeing submitted now, or some of the people that you see coming to you with their client, and you think to yourself, are you shitting me? This person's willing to, has any of that happened with you guys in the last 3 to 5?
I see Elizabeth.
The last project that I did with Wayne Powers called Loves Me, Loves Me Not. And, you know, you have Wayne who's, you know, written Italian Job and Deep Blue Sea. He's done, you know, quite a bit of work. And then we had a few reps come and, you know, submit their actors, and we were surprised, you know, along the way. That so that was my first time, you know, being able to reach out to reps, and they, you know, they're interested immediately just based on, you know, having that name attached to the project. And I look forward to seeing where it's going to go from here. You know, having these actors on board, as well as the director, he directed and wrote this film. So
I was surprised. We got it was my first feature ever, Roads, Trees, and Honeybees, came out last year, and we got Chris Mulkey in it. He's been in a lot of stuff, Whiplash, On the Basis of Sex, and just talking to him, I mean, he's from, I think, Port Washington it was, or someplace in Wisconsin, and so am I. So we just kind of talked a little bit on set about that, and he liked the character that he got to play, and I think that's the reason maybe why he decided to grace us with his presence on this, you know, ultra low budget feature film. Like, yeah. But it was good, and you can find those actors that want to do it. It just takes a little time to find it. You know, we're all humans at the end of the day. There's certain people that were fulfilled in certain ways and maybe unfulfilled in others, and you never know what's going to spark a chord in them.
Well, my experience has been actors love to act. So you can, if you can get to actors and especially give them an opportunity to do something that may not be what they're typically stereotyped in for Hollywood, many times you can gauge and get their interest. But specific to what you're talking about when it comes to distribution, more and more, they want A-list names. This idea of getting some B-plus or an ensemble of 3 or 4 or even 5 B names, distributors are like, yeah, and who's going to sell the movie? You know, so that's,
on 300 grand?
That, I'm telling you.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, but that's the problem that we have as independent filmmakers, is to really hopefully do this and continue to do it. And I'm not talking about becoming rich, make a modest profit so that we can continue to do what we, you know, do what we do. Is becoming,
well, Lisbon needs a job.
Is becoming harder and harder and harder. So, I mean, I recently did a film, and I can't really go through specific names, but I recently did a film where I could name five actors that we had in the film that all of you would recognize their name. You would, they all have at least one major television series that they were on that you could go, okay, yeah, that they have a fan base. And our, I had a distributor that was like, yeah, you got to get a real name or you guys are screwed.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
So
the room just fell silent. And you didn't notice that.
That was a modified project. But again, you know, we had to go find a way to make that viable. You know, and the other thing I want to be clear, when you work in the independent film world, distribution isn't a payout. It's a speculative promise that we're going to take your film and we're going to go try and sell it. And then we'll, sometimes it's a split, a revenue share where they take a piece of it and you take a piece of it.
Yeah,
sometimes,
well, they people.
Sometimes they'll give you a little bit of a, you know, an MG or some money up front, but it's usually not you making profit. It, you know what I mean? So
it's like selling on consignment
on some level. Yeah. I mean, it's wow. On some level. So understand that, like, running around going, yeah, I got a Netflix deal. Well, Netflix might only sign your film for 6 months and might only give you X amount of dollars that they pay out over a year. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Or whatever company. And then you still have to go figure out how to sell your movie and get back the profit. So it's a tricky thing. And don't get me wrong, I had a film that went to Netflix, which is great. It's great for that to be part of us. Oh, yeah, we had a film that went to Netflix. That sounds great for investors. But that doesn't necessarily in itself, in and of itself, mean that movie made money.
Yeah. Can you show your next investor those sales reports? Quarterly.
I have a question, as you know, for all you guys, as you're talking about trying to get freaking A-list actors on a $300,000 budget. I mean, how does it work for you when you're trying to compete for that talent and for these sales things, when you're also going up against what I would almost call faux indie groups, you know? Focus Features. I mean, this kind of Fox Searchlight where you're like, hold up now.
Yeah.
Wait a second. You got like three A-listers. You're going to tell me this shit's an indie film? Like, come on.
Yeah.
When we started the No Budget Film Festival about 10 years ago, the idea was to provide a space where all these filmmakers could come and beg, borrow, and steal their way into cutting something together and then putting it up on a screen in various locations around. We worked with the Vista Theater and with Max Sennett for a couple of years to host those things, and then also would try and, you know, use our measly contacts in the industry to see if we could bring people on to host kind of like a meet and greet for our filmmakers, just trying to say, like, look, there's possible connection. It's possible to connect with people who are already up here because the gap feels like how do you jump up there. And the first couple of years we'd sit around and think, gosh, it's wild that, like you said, these quote independent films that are off at con, and it's like, I don't know, Johnny Depp's like, I'm casually the star of this indie film and I've just spent $400 and that's it to make the film that I want to submit somewhere, please, it's my first film. That gap feels so insurmountable, and where is that boundary? And there's ultra low budget, which even still is not that low for some people who are trying to make a mark. Just, I don't know if I'm really answering anything, but just that there is that need for, where is the start? Where do you get to that threshold where you can start even talking to people about what A-list means for a small budget?
Does that cause you, depending on where you're at, next project, next thought, may not be for some of you, but does that cause you to default back to doing a short, or that's only where you start? Or is there a way for shorts to actually get you someplace for the next one at this point? Aside from, you know, yes, the Oscars, and we get that. There are places where it will elevate you, but how much does the concept of doing a short agreement come into play for all of you guys?
I think it's different with what you're looking at for it. I did one short film and then jumped and did two features. So if I were to go back to a short, it would be as a director, because directing is where I ultimately want my career path to go. I've been able to write, and I wrote my features, you know, and I've been able to produce, not the contract side, but the thing is like, where do I want my career to go? If I want my career to go in directing and I have the opportunity to direct a short film, I'm going to do it. As an investor in my films, am I going to put my money into a short film, or am I going to save up maybe a little bit more and put it towards one of my features? Then I would do feature. That's just a personal choice.
Stephanie's made money, just in case everybody didn't know. She's made money. We want to get that clear on this podcast. Call Stephanie.
And what I hear you saying, Stephanie, is that, like, if you're going to do a short, you're not necessarily investing in that short. You're investing in where you want your career to go as a director. Now, can a short make money?
Absolutely. Yes. Anything's possible.
You know, and maybe it's
really? You know, anything's been, possible.
Is that possible?
I could win the lottery tomorrow.
I have a few shorts you want to pay me for.
If you don't, buy a lottery ticket, you cannot win.
Yeah, well, and there's shorts and web series that have been turned into series. Like, it's a platform. But again, I think in most of those cases, that was somebody as a writer. They wanted to help their career as an actor and as a writer, so they created something for themselves, and then that got picked up. But what I kind of heard you speaking to is, if I'm going to do a short, I'm going to invest in my career as a director and in a direction that I want to move in, where maybe there is an opportunity in the feature world. So I'm all for shorts. I'm a filmmaker. I like making films. Like, I have an animated short I want to do, and I've never done animation. You know, I'm all for that as an exercise for me to explore the things I want to do. Can I find a way to monetize that? Maybe, maybe not. But as a filmmaker, I'm all for it. Like, go do it. As a moneymaker, I'm like, if I'm going to put, you know, let's say a good budget for a short, let's say if I'm going to put $10,000 into a short or $20,000 into a short, I'm kind of like, well, I could go find some more money and just do a feature and maybe have something I can sell, a better chance of selling.
Okay. We just finished episodes related to influencers. So when it comes to low budget filmmaking, sorry, I got four smiles and Max just passed out. I'm kind of curious. And again, all this is for the audience, guys. You have people listening to this who've now changed their mind six times about how they want to start doing something because they're sitting someplace going, oh, what am I going to do now? But where we're at today, how much do you guys find you either get approached, requested, pitched, and or expected to try and put somebody who does not have any acting chops, but has a whole bunch of people following them into a project like this where, again, we all know Stephanie has her own money. And she's at, but how, I'm just kidding, Stephanie.
Stephanie's like, man, I am never getting an investor again.
I know.
She's really close to picking up the bottle of water and throwing it at me. How much are influencers in play now in this arena?
I think I've seen where that has become a big deal as far as having, you know, social media influencers attached to projects. And, you know, I've worked with some social media influencers, you know, wanting to do web series and, you know, hoping it would get picked up from there. And they have that fan base, but then you don't necessarily have the acting chops.
What if they can't act?
I mean, that's for them, because like if they're doing something that their audience doesn't want to see, right, what does it matter?
But they might actually like that, you know, if you write something for them. It's like they have, I'm not a huge social media person myself. We have an Instagram account. It's blank until I have like the next film, or then I'll start on it again. But other than that, it's like things haven't changed. But that's just a personal thing. But the way that the world is going is social media has a lot of influence. Yeah. And these people who have created an entire career out of getting a following in some kind of niche on social media I respect that, because I try, right? And then it's like, well, I'm not nearly as great at it as they are. So they found something really amazing and a talent that they have, and they've honed it. So if you can talk to them and maybe kind of put your pieces together, you know how to create these amazing films, they know how to get a message out and to get people to respond and actively comment on it and stuff like that. And if you can combine forces, why not?
Stephanie, you just did Wisconsin proud with that, like finding the bright side. And
I'm proud to be Wisconsin. That in life, because
hearing that, I'm proud to be from Wisconsin. So
I was going to say, we really have two Wisconsin in the room. I'm not saying I'm
because
there you go.
Everybody has a different path, and I think that's what I'm hearing from everybody, is we all have a different story of how we got something made or got it distributed or where our career has gone, and everybody does have a different story. So it's no book. It's just, you know, well, inspiration, I guess.
It's kind of interesting, and I'm about to force Max to talk on the mic, because the project that finished, you know, that we've been working on together, Valerie, is the woman who came up with the idea and who stars in it is sort of a burgeoning influencer. She does fitness and self-defense and women empowerment, and take it.
it's her name is Miriam Masip. She's amazing. Look her up, Commander Miriam on Instagram. We had worked together on a project like a year ago, and we'd been wanting to work together again, and she sort of came to me with this thing, and yeah, it was just an interesting sort of task of like take the pieces that are there and turn it into something that I think is more fleshed out and is a story. And the whole unknown element for me going into production was her acting, honestly. She's charismatic as fuck and so like great and dynamic, but I had never really seen her act before. The thing that we did a year ago had been just like a foot chase, basically like her running through the desert, so not a ton of dialogue in that, and English is not her first language, and so it was just all of these things of like, I don't exactly know how it's going to be, what's going to end up happening, but I set aside like basically one rehearsal with Matt and her, and one a couple times I just like got together with her and we figured out our own rapport, our own way of communicating ahead of time. So it was not as much of an unknown going in on that first day. And we had a bit of a shorthand of like, I kept throwing verbs at her and she kept spitting adjectives back at me. And I was resisting that for the first day.
Okay, that should be just a video by itself. just by itself, that should be a video.
You know, I was like, I don't know, condemn him or whatever. And she's like, so angrier. And I'm like, sure.
Like, where's the universal actor translator when I need it?
Exactly.
Here's a Cliff Notebook.
As an actor, man, I get annoyed with people who are like, no, don't give me an adjective. I'm like, just that's your job. It's called interpretation.
Translate that for me. Okay, so we're gonna end this with a little bit of what I started with, and trying to book in a lot of the conversation that happens out on the street, a lot of the conversation over the last 10, 12, 13 years about doing these types of projects. And it doesn't matter, you know, how you feel about it, but it kind of goes to the point a little bit about why you would do a short now has to do with a different reason. Like, it might be because Stephanie, you'd want to do more directing. So I'm throwing this at everybody with this. What is your basic feeling in terms of somebody sitting out there who wants to go do one of these projects purely and only for the reason to somehow Taft Hartley themselves? What's your general opinion about that for someone who's not a union member yet? And if I'm going to keep talking, Gerald's going to interrupt me anyway. So G, you go ahead and take that.
Well, I think there's another side to that question that I'm going to address. So first off, like, I don't think you should do anything just to Taft Hartley yourself. You should act because you want to act and you want to gain experience and you want to get better. And
that's why I asked the question, man.
Just getting Taft Hartley, you're going to find out really quickly that there's a whole lot of other people with more experience and, you know, and a different skill set that you're going to have to compete with. Like, go work as much as you can. So specific to that, and I know, you know, you've been a proponent of raising the minimums, like the ULB number, and they just announced this new contract where it's $201 a day, which as a producer is a little problematic for me because that's a 61% increase in that pay rate, in that base pay rate. That's a big increase, like overnight. But what I'll say is, as an actor and a member of the union who, yeah, I want to make more money, I am forever indebted to the ultra low budget contract, the modified low budget contracts. And the reason is, I got to be in dozens and dozens of movies opposite name and recognizable stars. I got to develop my skill set. I went from, you know, probably bad. I think we're all bad at when we first start to, you know, now I'm a seasoned veteran actor that works on TV regularly. So and that even at $125 a day, I would do it over again because it gave me my career and allowed me to develop into a professional. So I will forever be indebted to those contracts. So I'm always like, listen, we as actors always talk about it. Perpetually, we're unemployed. We get a job, we work for a day or a week or 2 weeks, and then it's like, hey, you're unemployed again. Mm-hmm. And then we're waiting around or we're running to auditions and we're trying to find work. And I would rather go work on a low budget project and make $200 a day, $125 a day, plus OT, $335 a day on a modified contract. I would much rather go do that and continue to hone my craft, continue to gain experience, continue to gain material for my reel, continue to make relationships with producers, directors, actors, distributors, so that I can continue. And literally my whole career, even as a producer, because I started solely as an actor, all of it is based on the platform that the ULB and the modified low budget contract gave me. So when I hear people criticize just the number or the 125 a day or the now 201 a day, it really doesn't tell the whole story. You know, I can't tell you how thankful I am to those two contracts for allowing me to develop into a professional. And if I had had to wait for network TV to hire me, I don't know if I'd be the professional I am today.
No, that's why I'm asking you how much needing or wanting to be, get your card and be in the union or become Taft-Hartley drives you. Cause I'm always an origin guy. We've known each other for a long time, you know, drives you to direct, to do a short.
It's about acting.
But to drive you to choose to do a project.
I think the reason that we're all able to be here in this room, even have this conversation, is because we didn't wake up one day and say, hey, yesterday I decided I wanted to Taft-Hartley myself, so today I'm going to go do it. Then we wouldn't know what we're talking about. We wouldn't have any way to kind of talk about the various angles of being in the trenches of any one of these roles that we're in. And the reason why I can have this conversation is because 7 years ago I got Matt to sign a signatory waiver for me for a film that I did, and so then I could keep growing. And you know, and if you just are in it, thank you.
There's a reason I invited you.
and if the goal is just, well, I'm going to launch myself to this bracket up here without seeing all the in between, then you don't even have the language to talk to other people that you want to bring along with you or who might be able to lift you up. You don't speak the same language because you just skipped a whole bunch. It's like shoots and ladders in the wrong direction, and I don't think that serves all the different growing pains that are important.
I think it's really nice, though, that with the ULB and the modified low budget, you can still use non-union actors and union actors because it does help the producers out. And it does give you the ability to work with people and to learn from others. What I will say is that we didn't talk about the bond that SAG AFTRA collects because the world of it all, like, you know, if you get actors are amazing and they're so important and they're really talented, but on an independent budget, sometimes the only union, it's not like we were in the directors union or the writing union, we're just using SAG-AFTRA as the union. So our actors are getting paid. Yes, it might be 125 a day or 175, whatever it is with the, but you get collected something, but we pay something else, right? Because of insurance.
Correct.
So other people might not be getting paid up front. They might be that deferred pay for any of their other roles, which is after the investor gets paid back, and which is after then you start making money. And like we just established earlier, that might never
Matt's
happen.
Still waiting for his check, by the way.
But actors are right. So you have the being in the union, you have the support of the union to make sure that you do get paid and to make sure that you do get your overtime and you use that. So that is really great for an actor to have. But if you Taft-Hartley, I don't know if this is a question. If I were to Taft-Hartley myself, my project would have to be ULB or ultra low budget, right? ULB or modified low budget.
Well,
right?
for Taft-Hartley.
To Taft-Hartley, like if I was an actor and wanted to Taft-Hartley myself, my project could be that. Right. But then they would take a bond.
You can do it on any of them. So technically, like the new media contract, like you're in the union.
And
they don't take a bond.
Not
generally,
for the new media.
No. It depends on the budget.
That's like part two of this conversation. I say
well, that would
the
be like catch 22 of it. It's like if I want to be in the union, that's cool. But then I pay my dues and this and that. But I'm also whatever project I might be creating. Yep. Also loses some money from it. You know what I mean? It's Hollywood catch 22. I mean, anything's possible too.
Well, bond wise or deposit wise that's what's tricky. So yes, again, as a member of the union, I'm glad that they put protections in place and say, hey, you have to put up a bond so that we make sure you pay your payroll and your P&H. The problem with that as a producer is I have to put up, say, on a $300,000 budget, a $10,000 deposit. I have to put that in before we start. I then have to pay the payroll every week we're filming.
And their deposit as well.
Right. So we pay the payroll. Then when I'm done the film, I have to pay my P&H and I'm supposed to get my deposit back. Sometimes getting that deposit back takes months and months and after everything's been paid. Now, if I were to pay you guys months and months late, I would get a percentage tacked on by SAG that have penalties, whether it's the payroll or the P&H. I'd have to deal with the state if I don't pay you via payroll for your work. And now, if I do everything exactly the way I'm supposed to do it, I may wait sometimes 6 months, 8 months, long you're times not, to get my deposit
have
back.
Have you ever just showed up there? I'm just kidding. Don't do that. I did it twice.
Yeah, you'll get arrested.
Yeah. the irony
don't go
is,
bang on the door.
The irony is in this conversation today, and it's an outstanding episode, is that conversation right there is how Gerald and I started with this conversation, was that about getting your money back.
It is, it is hard to hear as a, because I've done a couple products. I've tried producing and I hate producing. I give you guys so much credit for being producers. But as a union member, it's like, you know, I know you guys have to go through all these hoops in order to use me. And then on the back end, you've got this money that's just being held there. And it's either because somebody's not moving fast enough or somebody's not.
Liz said something earlier that was really like, she said, you have to stay on top of SAG. You have to stay on top of the business agents. Absolutely. Even when you're going to get approved, like, it's almost like that's one of the issues is sometimes it's like, I don't know if your experience, sometimes where I'm calling two or three times a day and just not getting a call back, and we're 2 days or 3 days from production. Right. And I'm like, guys, I need to get approved. You have my check for the bond. I need to go. Yeah. And am I going to have to push, you know, the amount that's in the balance?
Too, on top of just making those phone calls.
Well, we're gonna bring it to a close there. Otherwise, Gerald will be here for another 20 minutes on that. But that is a good place for part two. Gerald, Max, Stephanie, Elizabeth, Anna, and my man, Matthew Jaeger. Hey. Awesome episode on low budget, ultra low budget producing. Thank you guys very much.
Yeah, thank
awesome.
You guys.
Thank you.
Make sure to download the next episode. I'd like to thank Blue Microphones. Their mics are fantastic and their headphones killer. The Gator Case Company, your equipment can travel in style. Protect your investment. PreSonus, I just love their Studio Live series. The Rode Corporation, the filmmaker kits, ambisonic microphone, and recorders all rock. And of course, Tascam, the Model 24 has been amazing. Need music for a podcast, television project, film, audiobook, or any other production need? I suggest you call my friends at Spirit Production Music. You can find them and listen to their music at spiritproductionmusic.com. Representing over 50 music libraries and over 200,000 tracks, Spirit Production Music has all the music you'll need, staff to help, and prices you'll love. Email them through their website or give them a call today at 818-508-2040. That's 818-508-2040. Ask for my buddy Ryan. He'll personally help you find the right music for your project. SpiritProductionMusic.com. Check them out. You'll be thrilled.